Now I want you to gird yourself for a journey down to the Slough of Despond. One of my great heroes is Winston Churchill. I was in Jim Dobson's office. Jim Dobson heads up Focus on the Family. Just shortly after he had built in his new facilities in Colorado Springs, Jim has this fantastic office. And he has three portraits in his office. He has a painting of Jesus, one of the well-known paintings of the face of Jesus, portrait number one. And then he has a self-portrait by his father, obviously of his father, in case you didn't get that, because of the powerful influence that Jim's father had had on his life. And then the third portrait is a portrait of Winston Churchill. And I confess, right here and now, I was envious. An original painting, he picked it up, I think, when he was on a trip through Ireland a few years ago. And I was envious. I'm dying to go and scour the countryside of Ireland to see if I can find an oil painting of Winston Churchill. But I would love to have that somewhere in my office. I tried painting him myself once. I have a watercolor that I did. One of my few stabs at watercolor. But right now I haven't had the courage to put it up yet. It's lying hidden somewhere. But Winston Churchill, a wonderful, wonderful man. And it reminds me of a story. He and Lady Astor were arch enemies, and they would often go at each other in Parliament. She took every opportunity she could to humiliate him, to criticize him. One day she was furious at some thing that happened in Parliament, and Churchill had got his way, and she stood up and she shouted out at him, "Sir Winston, if you were my husband, I would poison your tea." And he replied, "Lady Astor, if I was your husband, I'd drink the tea." On another occasion, Winston had been out drinking a little too much. She came upon him in a restaurant once, and he was obviously a little inebriated. So she thought she'd take the opportunity, and she called out to him, "Mr. Prime Minister, I perceive you are drunk." To which Winston replied, "Lady Astor, yes I am. And I perceive you are ugly. But I shall be sober in the morning." he's a wonderful man, and his repartee was great. But one of the things that encourages me about Winston Churchill, I sort of devour that those two volumes, The Last Lion, if you're familiar with them. That is the story of Winston's life, and there are several things about his life that inspires me. I mean, one of them is the fact that he suffered from depression. The story is told that when he was in school, sent away to school, to Harrow, by an uncaring father, a father who resented him. You know, this kid had this ponderous body, this funny body and big head. His father, Randolph Churchill, didn't care for him much. Sent him away to school. His mother hardly loved him. He was raised by a nanny. Many, many times he would cry himself to sleep at night. And I remember my own early teenage years, lying there, crying myself to sleep, you know. He suffered from depression, horrible depression. There was a man until he was almost 70. Everything had failed. Nothing had gone right. That's the other thing that encourages me about him. You know? And suddenly, 1939 was his moment. Oh, 70 years of preparation to be the man for that moment. I'm encouraged by that. not 70 yet. And maybe there's something out there waiting still. But I'm encouraged by him in many ways, but not the least of which was the fact that he suffered from a horrible depression. And so do many others, folks. I don't know how it is possible to be a pastor and not know something about depression. Know it for yourself. Know it in the hearts of others. Depression is the common cold of the emotions. There is no other human experience more common than that of depression. Oh, I know, there's a bunch of you out there who would, by the way, I would say would want to shout out, and feel free to do so. I'm going to change the rules on these microphones. I don't think it works. We're too big to get to a microphone. So I'm going to encourage you to ask your questions as I go along. Raise your hand and I'll repeat the question so it's on the tape. So feel free to interact with me as I proceed. But I know that there's some of you who would want to say, oh, I have never suffered from depression. Never. Yeah. There are a lot of people who say. The problem is, you see, it's so difficult for some people to understand what depression is. And I say, oh, is that so? Have you never felt this way? Oh, yeah, sure, sure. Have you never had this experience? Have you? Oh, yes, yes, yes. I said, that's what depression is, idiot. I get so angry at people who say, I never get depressed. What it means is, you're too stupid to know what depression is. Now, let's fix that this morning, okay? A few words from Philippians. Chapter 3. This is a wonderful book, you know that. It's all here. And the Apostle Paul also knew what depression was all about. But as you will see as I proceed, I think the Apostle Paul came to a place in his life where his head sort of broke through the dark cloud. You know, I have this image, you know, the Apostle Paul, his head through the cloud, everything the cloud from my neck down, folks. My head is through it now. Nothing more you can do to me. And he shares that experience in Philippians chapter 3, and I'm going to read just a few verses from verse 7, and I trust that before our morning is over, you will have a deeper understanding of what the Apostle Paul is trying to say here. He writes, but whatever was to my profit, I now consider loss. He's been talking about the fact that he had reasons to put confidence in the flesh. He more than anyone. He was circumcised. On the eighth day of the people of the tribe of Benjamin, a Hebrew of the Hebrews. In regard to the law, he was a Pharisee. As for zeal, he persecuted the church. I mean, he had a long list of qualifications. And now he writes, but whatever was to my profit, I now consider loss for the sake of Christ. What is more, I consider everything a loss compared to the surpassing greatness of knowing Christ Jesus, my Lord, for whose sake I have lost all things. I consider them rubbish, that I may gain Christ and be found in Him, not having a righteousness of my own that comes from the law, but that which is through faith in Christ, the righteousness that comes from God and is by faith. I have lost all things. The common cold of the emotion. We misunderstand depression. So let me at the outset try to correct a few errors. Depression is a healing emotion. It was designed into us at creation. I do not believe depression is the consequence of the fall. Now, before the fall, there was no depression because there was no loss. The fall brought loss. And so the mechanism building, one of the problems we have with the fall is, did God recreate us after the fall? And I don't believe that's true. I think that puts you into all sorts of theological dilemmas, binds, that we are today as God created us. So when you look at the body and you see that built into us, designed into us, is a mechanism that makes us depressed under certain conditions, you have to pull back and say, well, that's how God created it. It must have a purpose. Now, the fall increased the potential for abuse of that system, and so depression is more common. In fact, there was no depression before the fall. So depression is post-fall. But that doesn't make it sinful in and of itself. Depression is a healing emotion. It is a healing emotion if you cooperate with it. And that is my one single sentence that summarizes everything I want to say about depression. How do we cooperate with it and turn it into a healing emotion? I've written a number of books about depression because right from the very earliest days of my clinical practice, depression has been a particular challenge for me. It's been a challenge personally, but more than that, when I started practicing, it was a time when we had very little that we could do for severely depressed people. I hate to think what life must have been like more than 50, 60 years ago, when there was absolutely nothing for depression. The first thing that came along that offered some hope was electroconvulsive therapy in the late 30s, 1930s, the late 1930s. That came on the market. And would you believe it? It, for those who are in this absolute extreme, horrible nightmare of severe depression, it offered hope. Of course, it was abused. But still, it offered hope. When I started clinical practice, antidepressant medications had only just been invented. They were not common yet. And so you went into a major depression. You had 3 years of absolute hell and misery. In a very, very severe depression. There was little hope. I'm pleased to be able to report today that the easiest depressions to fix are those same severe depressions that at one time caused people to go and blow their brains out or take their life because they couldn't stand it anymore. Those are the easiest. So there's a lot of hope today. But paralleling this hope that people have for severe depression is a strain of misinformation and ignorance about the nature of depression. And we in the Christian church, in the evangelical Christian church, more than any other group, have perpetuated. I put the blame on Satan. I think Satan has somehow got us off track there and capitalizes and utilizes it. It's got us into believing that somehow depression has no place in the Christian's life. That to be depressed means ipso facto to be unspiritual. In fact, if you come with me to the United States and listen to one of those television, radio, Christian television programs, And you call in because they all got these telephone lines, which are, let's face it, primarily fundraising devices. But they're calling with your problems, and you give your prayer request, and they've got these mountains and mountains of prayer requests, and they show them on television, you know, and we're going to pray for all these, like you can mass produce prayer. You know? And then there are boxes and boxes of them behind there somewhere that people don't even get to see. They've never been brought forward and prayed for. But if you call up one of those helplines and you say, you know, I'm in a very deep depression, you know the message you get? Because I know that people come to me all the time. This is a letter I got from those people. I'm in this deep depression. I called them up for hope, and they said to me, the reason you are depressed is because you're out of the will of God. The reason you're depressed is because God has turned his back on you. The reason you are depressed is because God no longer wants to have anything to do with you. Can you imagine? Is that our God? We misunderstand depression. And oh boy, I sure hope that there's a day of accounting. If there isn't, God's going to be in trouble for me. I can assure you that. I'm going to complain. I'm going to complain. Wherever the complaint center is, I'm going to complain. I want to say right at the outset, point number one: surviving the ministry is surviving depression. I mean this. And it's a matter of surviving depression for two reasons. One, first of all, that ministry more than any other vocation has the potential for setting you up for depression. I'll say a little more about that later. And the second reason I say that is because depression is so common that being in ministry doesn't exclude you. Doesn't exclude you. And depression is essentially common for ministry for the main reason that I put down right under the point number one. That is that ministry is loss prone. To understand that, let me just explain that all depressions can be divided into two categories. It's as simple as that. Two major categories of depression. There are a group of depressions that are essentially biological in nature. They are biological. Whatever you think about it, it's essentially biological. And then there are another group of depressions that are essentially psychological. In one case, there's something wrong with our biology. In the other case, there's something wrong with our mind, our thinking, something has happened. Someone has said that depression is a cry in the soul that says something is missing. That's a beautiful expression. But that refers only to the psychological depression. A cry in the soul, something is missing. Nothing to do with biological. I need to keep making sure that we separate out and we clarify. Because the problem is, you see, we have one word, we have one label, and that label is the same label for both. We should have had two separate labels for it. Call the one depression, call the other one something else. But we don't. We only have one. And the reason there's only one label is because the experience of it is common to both. That's the problem. That when you have this something missing stuff, or when you have something wrong with the biology, the experience is the same. There are subtle differences, and I think that pastors should know what those differences are. So I hope that before this morning is over, you will be able to see and recognize when the one is one type versus the other. But you're going to need it, you must know that these two are separate. Now let's take the psychological depression first of all. Because this is the most common one. This is the one that everybody experiences. The other one only some of us experience. But the psychological is universal. We're designed for it. Blame God. That's how we are created. And this psychological depression is best understood as a reaction to loss. A reaction to loss. Psychological depression is essentially a response to loss. That's what this phrase means. A cry in the soul. Something is missing. Something's gone missing. Something is lost. Which means that whenever we experience loss of any sort, something happens. This wonderful mind that God has created in us starts a process that must run its course. And if it doesn't, if it is short-circuited, if something happens to it so that it can't run its course, then we're not cooperating with it, and then the depression gets out of control and it becomes a punishment. It becomes a horrible experience. It has lost its way. And our goal, my model is, get depression back on track and make sure you keep it on track and do the thing that it's supposed to do, then it is a healing emotion. Now, there are several reasons why ministry is loss prone. I just want to quickly mention them. You know it probably as much as I do. The first reason that there's a lot of loss in ministry, because it has to do with people. People, unpredictable people. People who make promises and don't keep them. People who stab you in the back. People who sabotage things. And so every vocation that works with people has a potential for a lot of loss. You've got to be able to recognize those losses and deal with them. Part of it is what you've got to do is downgrade your expectations for people. Why is it we expect people to be perfect? We're not. Why do we expect people to be perfect? Plan on it, folks. Plan on the fact that they're not going to be perfect. That they're going to let you down. Have a backup plan for that. You can diminish your level of frustration a whole bunch if you just adjust your expectations a little bit. This is, the church is broken. The church is full of broken people. That's what the church is about. In its human form. Yes, they're becoming the bride of Christ, but as a gathering of humans in that church, they are imperfect. And consequently, many pastors get into trouble because they keep expecting the people to behave like they were the true church. It's your task to move them to that. That's your job. Don't complain about it because they're not perfect. And another reason why ministry is full of potential for loss is the idea that it's a high calling. Now, I happen to believe it is a high calling. If you haven't been called by God, get out of ministry. It's too hard otherwise. You've got to be called to this work. But you can carry this idea that's a high calling too far. You know, that it's a sort of, I say it as a sort of a theology of divine entitlement. Yes, that's a high calling. Therefore, I'm entitled. God, I'm entitled to special privileges. Don't you get the message? Okay, that, you know, the riffraff, the ordinary, yeah, they can have one prayer in 10 answered, but I expect every prayer to be answered. I'm a pastor. The divine entitlement. No, you don't have any more entitlement than any other Christian believer. I happen to believe in the priesthood of all believers. It drives our Presbyterians at Fuller up the wall, but I happen to believe that. And the Anglicans even worse still. But, you know, that's my Baptist roots, man. I believe in the priesthood of all believers, you see. And they are as much priests as we are. That's the glory of our tradition. But we have no divine entitlement. So just get that idea straight. And another reason for loss proneness is this thing of boundaries again that I mentioned. And I keep thinking I should point you to some resources, but there's a book by Cloud. What's his first name? Henry Cloud on boundaries. That I think is excellent. It's a very good book. Yes, it's Cloud and Townsend. That's correct. On boundaries. And you know, there's a lot of boundary violation. Boundaries, always a sense of loss. When someone oversteps my boundary, I feel a sense of loss. I feel a sense of loss of control. And you see, loss can be many things. It's not just loss of when I've, you know, misplaced, lost some money. Loss isn't only when you get a traffic ticket and I'm going to cough up a whole bunch of money for a traffic ticket. Loss isn't only when I'm away from my grieving daughter and my grieving grandson. That's loss. I've been very aware of a low-grade, persistent sadness while I've been away for 6, maybe 7 weeks now. I'm looking forward to Friday when we go back and I can take my daughter and hold her. The loss of sadness. There's a loss proneness in ministry where we begin to lose the sense of dream.
our ideals. So that's the problem with this people stuff. Is if you're not careful, if your theology isn't solid, if it isn't founded on a solid footing, you know, that thing I referred to yesterday, that theological anemia, is lost. And this pervasive sense of nothing helps. It's a sense, it's helplessness, you know. The concept of helplessness is another one fascinating, and wish we had time to spend a whole session on looking at the whole issue of helplessness. Helplessness is you're sitting behind the wheel of your car, and now you go over the hill and you're going downhill and the road's like this, and you try to put your foot on the brake, and the brakes don't work. You turn the steering wheel and the steering wheel doesn't work. You know that feeling? The only thing I experienced worse than that, not that I've ever experienced it, that I've had the experience of no brakes, boy. Helpless. And helplessness, and the only close thing I can remember when I learned to fly many years ago, one of the routines, one of the acrobatics we had to learn was to put a plane in a spin and learn how to recover from that. They don't let you do it in the States. It's illegal to do a spin in the States, but Africa, you've got all the wild, the only airplane in the sky. Who cares what you do with it? And so, you know, those of you who have done some flying will know that to put it in a spin, what you've got to do is you get up high. I mean, go up real high, high as you can get. And then you slow the plane down, you cut the throttle, and you go into engines idling, and you're just gliding. And then you slowly pull back on the stick, because as you glide, you lose speed, and the plane will start to dip down, so you've got to pull the nose up. And just before it stalls, you kick hard on the left or right rudder, depending whether you want to go left or right. And you pull back on the joystick. And the plane flips over on its backside. And the next thing, you're looking straight down at the ground, and it's spinning like this. It's better than bungee cord jumping, I can tell you that. And the ground is spinning like this. And the instructor will sit next to you, and my instructor used to carry a ruler. And he waited for this moment, and then he'd say, hands off the controls, whack! You know? Because to recover from a spin, you've got to take your hands off the controls. You've got to take your feet off the pedals. You've got to let go! Because a well-designed aeroplane will slowly stop spinning, go into a shallow dive, and then you put your hands back on the controls, and you give it juice, and off you go. But if you hold on to those controls, you'll crash. It's the end. And by that moment when you've got to take your hands off the pedals and the controls, talk about helplessness. Our instinctive reaction is grab onto something, hold on to something, do something. And helplessness. And that's given rise to a whole school of theory. Of depression by a man by the name of Seligman called the helplessness theory. That he sees a lot of depression as a consequence of helplessness. And in ministry there's a lot of helplessness, feelings of helplessness. Of course, I think that my model covers that. Depression is a response to loss. And in helplessness what we have is a loss of control. But it's still loss, you see. So I think that one single concept is a beautiful way of bringing it all together. And I've got a simple mind, and I like things to be simple and easy to grasp. So there are many reasons why ministry has potential for loss, and because of that, there's a potential for depression. And you've got to know how to recognize it and deal with it. And the better you can do it for yourself, get that comfort for yourself, the easier it is to begin to help your people who are suffering the same issues in depression as you. Yes, I'm glad for. Go ahead. Yeah, some people say that depression is anger turned inward. That's a question. You want me to comment on that? Yes. That is a Freudian concept. And there's very little of Freud that we should believe. No, I'm joking. I often overstate things. I should correct. I say I hate students No, I don't really hate students. I say it to ventilate. No, I don't. But and I don't mean that by Freud. We are indebted to Freud. In fact, when I say depression is a response to loss, that's Freud's discovery.
But he took it further. He noticed that whenever people were depressed, they were also very angry. And where Freud made his mistake is his interpretation of the fact. He was very accurate in describing the human condition. And so we have these defense mechanisms. We have much that we are enriched by through Freud. But he then interpreted it. He said, well, since there's anger and there's depression that coexist, therefore the depression must be anger turned inward. And that's not true. It's not anger turned inward. But when I experience loss, I also get angry. There's a frustration. And so the two coexist. And so in the life of the pastor, yes, there's depression, but at the same time, the disappointment that sets up the depression also creates in me the anger. The anger is designed to overcome the loss. It's part of that inbuilt mechanism. So they coexist. We see it in bereavement, don't we? That often in bereavement, people go through a period when they get very angry. My daughter, for example, I remember driving home that night from the hospital, 2 o'clock in the morning, just Richard had died. And driving home with her, I said, honey, there may come a time when you will get very angry. And who will you get angry at, you think? Who did I? At God. I want you to know one thing. God didn't cause this. God did not cause this. Get your theology straight here. God is now in this with you. But don't blame Him for it. Because you see, God's a great scapegoat. Eh? Who else can we blame? God. You know? I think it's totally inappropriate to be angry at God. You'll never convince me that it's appropriate. I know we get angry at God, but stop. You only get angry at God because you don't know God. If you knew Him, you would never think you could get angry at Him. But, yes. Yes. And I want to come to that in a moment. Thank you. You've anticipated my next 2 points. I want to say that part of the problem with depression is that it often arises out of bad theology. Bad theology. The idea, well, why God didn't God prevent it? Because God doesn't stop everything. God doesn't stop anything. There's a natural law at work. We reap what we sow. We reap what we sow. And so that law is at work. God does not prevent all suffering. There is a natural law that continues to operate. Now, thank God He intervenes in the natural law of things regularly, but we call that a miracle. But if everything were a miracle, then there'd be no natural law. There's no way. If I go and lie out in the sun for 5 hours in a hot Australian on a hot Australian beach, I'm going to get cancer. Why didn't God prevent that? Because I'm stupid. That's why. And God never ever prevents the consequences of my stupidity. So the answer to that is very simply: there's a natural law at work. Things happen. Now, but our message as believers, as Christians, is that when tragedy happens, God steps in and God is there, and that's the miracle. That's the miracle. But there are two bad theologies that, two errors in theology that I think I need to challenge, and you may disagree with me, and you're entitled to. I mean, I'm not taking that away from you. You won't make me depressed because you disagree with me, I can tell you that. I long since took audiences out of my grandstand. That's an interesting thought. Have you never take an audience out of your grandstand? I'm going to say what I believe God wants me to say. I don't care what you think. Your loss. But two theologies that I think are bad, that we struggle with in the area of loss and depression. The first bad theology is the idea that depression must be God's punishment. In fact, that theology is bad when it believes that all bad things are God's punishment. I had a friend back in South Africa who, a pastor, Baptist pastor, who tragically lost his little son, his little boy, 3 years old, who drowned in a swimming pool. And for a long, long time, that father would not forgive himself, would punish himself. Kept saying, "It was my neglect to close the gate. Should have been watching him." And the father, as a consequence, his grief and his depression that followed was prolonged unnecessarily with the idea that this was God's punishment, you know. And then, I don't know, as I counseled with him, I don't know, he had a lustful thought 6 months ago or something. I don't know. You search for explanations, you see. And this is God's punishment. I said to him, "Why would God kill your son to punish you? What did the son do to deserve death?" It's illogical, let alone bad theology. It's illogical to begin with. Why would God punish me by hurting somebody else? "Oh, my wife, God's allowed my wife to develop a cancer because, you see, I've not been a good husband." It's bad logic. But it's also bad theology. And the theology that's bad here is the fact that God does not punish. We live in a day of grace. God has suspended punishment. Because the fact is that if God punishes me for something, then I've paid my debt. I don't need His forgiveness. You get the point? You can't have it both ways. You either take His forgiveness to avoid the punishment, or you go the other way, you let God punish you, and then you've paid your debt. And I think as evangelicals, we sometimes get this thing confused. Now, God disciplines. That's different. Discipline is not punishment. Is God as a deliberate act by God in retaliation for some sinful thing we have done. And that is on hold, folks, in the day of grace. Until the day I take my last breath, I have the freedom to choose God's punishment. Now, when people hurt us, we wish that wasn't so. Why doesn't God punish them right now? I would prefer it if God punished. But He doesn't. "Vengeance is mine, saith the Lord. I will repay." You want to be a part of this new covenant with me? Then I do the punishing and you do the forgiving. Bad theology. God disciplines, yes. Discipline is what we learn from the natural consequences of stupid behavior. So if I lie in the sun and I overburn my skin and I develop a cancer, the discipline is that God does not intervene. That's God's discipline. It's the non-intervention when we do stupid things. God allows certain things to happen because that is part of His love for us. But that's different to an intentional act of God in retribution for something, which, in my theology, is in suspension because we're in the day of grace. The day will come when it's all over. And then there will be the great accounting. Then God will punish. And that judgment day will be a horrible day for many, many people. The second bad theology, I think, that aggravates this depression idea, and I know I might be tramping on some toes here, but I want to suggest to you that when we believe that depression is some sort of demonic possession, we're also treading on thin ice. Now, I am not saying, I better explain to you, there's a thing called the arc of distortion by selective inattention. Shall I say it again? The arc of distortion by selective inattention. You only hear some words, you don't hear at all. It's, you know, this is what I say, and this is what you hear. And this arc of distortion is due to selective inattention. I'm not saying that there's no such thing as demonic possession. I'm not saying that demonic possession may not result in some depression. But the universal blanket judgment that all depression is demonic possession is a satanic lie. Satan would have you believe that. But it's a satanic lie. And there are scores and scores of people who suffer with intense guilt because they think that what they are experiencing is demonic possession. Sorry to say that it has more natural explanations than that. In an article I wrote for Leadership Magazine, I don't know, a year or two ago, I forget how long it was ago, they asked me to write an article about how can pastors tell whether something is satanic or whether it's a natural phenomenon. And the model I present is a parsimonious model. You always take the simplest explanation for things. It's the only way you can operate in life. You take the simplest explanation. If my foot is hurting, because every time I stand on it, the first thing I do is I take the shoe off and see if there's a nail there sticking in my foot. I don't immediately jump to the esoteric explanation, do I? But we love the esoteric. We love the complicated because it sounds so much more spiritual. If an antidepressant medication will take that depression away, and no matter how severe it is, in 3 weeks, the obvious thing we must conclude is that it is a natural phenomenon. And so my model in that article is a parsimonious approach. Take the most obvious explanation first. And then when you've ruled that out, move to the next most obvious. And then when you've ruled out all the natural explanations, then you're confronted with whether this is demonic. But don't move to the esoteric as a first step, because we fuel the lies that Satan thrives. And Satan is... I hope that your seminary, your college, teaches theology of Satan. People don't... You know, most people think that Satan is like God. That he can be everywhere at the same time. That's bad theology. Satan roams the earth. He's a person. He's not omnipresent like God. He's not omniscient like God. All the attributes that we give to God, the common average Christian person believes that those same attributes apply to Satan. We've got to do a lot of teaching here, Pastor. Teach your theories on the doctrine of Satan. Clarifying people's minds so they know who the enemy is. Because Satan thrives on lies. He is the arch deceiver. Okay. Depression in history, lots of evidence. Take the Elijah story. After the victory on Mount Carmel, over the prophets of Baal, goes and lies under the juniper tree and says, God, let me die, let me die. That's depression talk. Elijah's depression is a very interesting type of depression. It's what we call a post-adrenaline depression. When you've been on a high, you know, you've had a campaign, you've had this exciting thing going for a while. When it's all over, the next morning you wake up, how do you feel? Anticlimax. Deep depression. Every Monday morning, post-adrenaline depression. And the higher your adrenaline, the more you use your adrenaline to preach and all the rest of it. That's why I've got to be careful that I don't get too excited about things. The more you use your adrenaline, the deeper is the valley of depression, which follows. I know some pastors' wives tell me that they split on Monday mornings. They get out of the house. They go as far away as they can. Because this post-adrenaline depression sets in. What are the symptoms of post-adrenaline depression? High level of irritability. Cat, get out of the way. Doing. Pity the animals that live in your house. Or say, not the cat, then it's the kids. High level of irritability. Low tolerance for frustration. a restlessness. Can't sit still, can't concentrate. Lack of concentration. And then this rather fascinating or interesting loss of hope. You spiritualize it. You don't feel like you did anything good. Morbid. Despondent. Slough of despond. The post-adrenaline depression. And you know, the amazing thing is I've studied it and researched it. Not a lot written about it, by the way. You won't find many. And I don't think you're going to find any books on the topic. I've been doing quite a bit of research in this area. And even though I know it well, do you know it always eludes my recognition when I'm in it? I don't know I'm in it until I'm out of it. So that's the other problem with it. You just don't know it's there. I'll have a little more to say about it when we talk about stress tonight, because it really is a stress problem is what it is. The many causes of depression, I don't think I need to elaborate on that. Anything that has to do with loss. Depression in great preachers. I want to stop here for a moment, because depression has been a common experience in many, many significant persons. You know, John Wesley, Martin Luther. Martin Luther sobbed his last breath in a deep depression as he died. John Calvin. But of all the great preachers of history, the only one who got it right was Charles Spurgeon. And his writings on the topic are absolutely phenomenal. He has in his book Lectures to My Students, he has a chapter there on depression that is absolutely brilliant. And he gives the reasons for depression. He outlines them. And every time I look at them and I go through them, I marvel. He got it right way, way back then, when no one else understood it. Charles Spurgeon understood it. Why do we get depressed, he says, the strong are not always vigorous, the wise are not always ready, the brave not always courageous, and the joyous not always happy. There may be here and there men of iron to whom wear and tear work no perceptible detriment, but surely the rust frets even these. And as far as ordinary men are concerned, isn't that a lovely expression? He put himself in the category of ordinary men, not these supermen. The Lord knows they're but dust. Knowing by most painful personal experience what deep depression of spirit means, being visited there at seasons by no means few or far between, I thought it would be a consolation for me to share my thoughts. And then he goes on. Why do we get depressed, he says? Because we're men. Because we're human. That's right. It's designed into us. It's tied to our physiology, he says, especially of unsound physiology. If the work of a sedentary nature makes you lethargic, and that predisposes you to depression. Our work, if earnestly undertaken, lays us open. He's talking about stress. Talks about the leadership role and how it talks about the lack of exercise. And then when it's all done, he says, and finally, there are reasons we don't know. We don't know why we get depressed, but we do. We do get depressed. But Spurgeon tended not to see it as a spiritual downer. He understood its purpose. Jump down to point seven. The others are fairly straightforward and time is going. I need to now help you distinguish. I'm going to go to this board if I can. Should be a pen here. It's very important when we think about depression to think in terms of it being on a continuum from zero depression to a lot of it. 100% depression. Because depression ranges, that's the problem with this phenomenon, that it ranges, depression goes all the way from normal freedom from depression, and by the way, happiness is not the opposite of depression. Happiness is a is we say it's orthogonal. It's a different scale. It's happiness 0 to 100%. It's not the same as that. You can be in a deep sadness and yet also feel joyful, a sense of joy. So and happiness, they're not opposites. Don't make that mistake. But freedom from depression and then a high degree of depression. This is a continuum. Now, at a certain point, hypothetically, beyond that point, before that point, the depression is normal. By that I mean that just leave it be. Take your hands off the controls. The process will run its course. The less you interfere with it, the greater is the possibility that it will turn out to be a healing experience. Normal depression. Every day I have a little depression, normal, little disappointment. Maybe a letter I was expecting didn't come. Maybe a stupid student made some remark about my lecture last week. You know? So we receive it. It's a normal depression. Now, there's a lot we can do to help in the normal, to deal with normal depression, and let me short-circuit it and tell you where I'm headed, that all depressions require a grief response. Depression is a response to loss. And the second thing that Freud told us is that bereavement is no different to other losses. The loss of a loved one in death is the ultimate loss, and so it feels different, but it is in fact the exact same experience. All depression is a call to deal with the loss. And how do we deal with loss? What have we got to do to deal with loss? Come on, I can't hear you. Admit it, we've got to own it, but what's the ultimate outcome? To let go. The purpose of grief is to help us let go. See, God has designed us. All of life is loss. And so you come to a place where you've got to let go. If you've experienced legitimate loss, the grief process helps you to let go. So if I have been criticized for a bad sermon, or even if it's not a bad sermon, 96% of the criticism pastors experience is not justified. But if I've experienced that loss, it's a call to grief. Let it go. And normal depressions happen every day of our lives. Some of it we resolve by forgetting. and some losses, the best way to resolve them is just forget them. Discount them. They don't matter. It's not important. And so we take it off the loss agenda, and that resolves the depression. Other losses are more important than that. It's not easy to get it off the agenda. And therefore, it's a call to grief, and I want to talk about the grieving process, because that's what has to take place here. But beyond this hypothetical point, we say that the depression is clinical. It's no longer normal. It's gone beyond that. It is now clinical. So that in point seven, I say we have to differentiate between clinical and normal depression. And pastors need to know this. You need to know that at a certain point, the depression is clinical. And it becomes clinical in several ways. It becomes clinical, first of all, because the depth of the depression is more severe. It's clinical. It becomes clinical because the depression is being perpetuated. Something has gone wrong, and so instead of there being the appropriate response, depressive response to the loss, we're seeing more response than we should see. And this often happens when you have one loss on top of another. You ever had those periods in your life where one more thing has to go wrong? Now, what's happening is that whereas there is a certain appropriate depression for a given loss, as the losses begin to pile up, the depression sort of increases exponentially. So you get more depression for this. The last thing that happens that crowns it all for you is going to give you a lot more depression than if it happened just on its own. Escalate. Yes?
There is confusion then today. I mean, there's a great deal of talk about stress.
Yes, there's a lot of talk about stress. There's a lot of confusion between depression and stress, yes. And but the fact is that the stress road will ultimately bring you out in depression. So a lot of stress will ultimately manifest itself in depression. And I'm going to talk about in a moment the biological depression, and many biological depressions are triggered by stress. So you've anticipated me, and we move into that topic right now. Look at point number 8. I think it's important now. I've been talking up to this point about psychological depression, which is a normal response. It is built into us. It must be allowed to happen. Think for a moment. In bereavement, do we say to someone who has just lost a loved one, you know, the last thing you should do is get sad about that. I don't think God would be pleased with that. I mean, none of us would be that callous, right? What do we say to the bereaved person? Cry. Go cry. Did anyone watch this last episode of The Duchess of Duke Street? One, two, three. Wonderful. And I watched it years ago. It's a beautiful story, really, a love story. But this episode captured this. She's in bereavement. Lord Hazelmere has died now from his wounds. And she goes into this deep depression, and they portray it vividly. She wants to sell the hotel. She doesn't want to live. She has nothing to live for. Doesn't care about anything anymore. And she goes to visit her father, simple man. And the father says to her, why don't you cry? Cry. She can't cry. Deep depression. Well, the story ends with her getting this letter that Lord Hazelmere had written before he went to the First World War. And she just opens it, starts to read it, and she bursts out and she sobs and she sobs and she sobs. And the next moment, it's the next morning, she'd fallen asleep on her desk. And she gets up from that. The depression's gone. It's gone. And so in bereavement, we know people have got to, you've got to be depressed and you've got to give in to the sadness because something happens. God has created within us some mechanism that we don't quite understand is that when we allow ourselves to be sad, we let go. Now that's true for bereavement, but it's exactly the same. Get fired from a job. You know, have a church say, that's it, finished. We don't want you anymore. And you go into your deep depression. It's no different. The loss, the grief process is the same for all losses. But you get fired from the job. Then we're told, well, you know, we short-circuit the depression. We say, what did we say to somebody? Come out of it. Snap out of it. Come on. You can get another job. Oh, there are lots of churches who want pastors. What's that going to do with it? What's that got to do with it? I have this loss. I've got to grieve this loss. Now, the problem with us evangelicals, we don't grieve very well. We short-circuit it. It's unspiritual. We don't like people who are depressed, and so people know that, and so when they are depressed, they've got to put on a smiling face. They've got to put on a brave face for us. Because we won't allow people to grieve. If God doesn't hold us accountable for that one day, I'm going to be mad. Or depressed or something. But let me switch for a moment to the endogenous, because I want to wrap this up before we finish our morning first session. And then the second session this morning, I want to devote to the whole topic of this grieving process. And how can we help ourselves? How can we help our people deal with their depression? But switch to the biological for a moment. Let me give you some statistics. At any moment of time, 10%, 1 in 10, is suffering from a biological depression. 1 in 10. How many people do we have here? 250? There are 25 people here today who suffer from biological depression. That's the statistic. It's universal. It's true wherever you go. It's biologically determined. You'll see evidence of it in your family. It tends to be genetic. It's a recessive gene, so it dies out. But it is essentially biological. Women are twice as likely to be depressed as men. What did he say, ma'am? Hey? He knows that. Shame on you, sir. Shame on you. But and there are many reasons for that, not the least of which is the reproductive system that women have to bear. You men should have to carry babies, have babies for a while. Nature should have made it so it alternated, don't you think? If the men had to have the baby, there'd only be one child in the family. I think that's right. Well, but there's a penalty for that reproductive gift. I mean, it's a gift. There's a penalty for it. That system is very likely to get out of whack. The biochemical disturbances, which are essentially the cause of biological depression, are easily upset by the reproductive system. And so times of period, premenstrual syndrome, or tension, we call it, and also at times of cessation of menses, menopause, are heavily, heavily loaded with depression. So we see women are twice at risk. But let me just mention a couple of other statistics that are important for you to know. The risk of killing yourself when you are depressed in the biological depression is 20%. One in five. One in five people will try to take their lives and will probably be successful. Now, the thing about these biological depressions is that they do tend to recur. They come in episodes. Usually, the longest episode, in the days when we didn't have treatment for it, that you could expect 3 years of hell, and then it would lift. And maybe it would lift for 6 months, and then we'd be back again. I mean, this is horrible, horrible stuff. There are some who we call rapid cyclers. In other words, they have hundreds of episodes every year. Now, the really alarming statistic to me is this, that of those who suffer from biological depression, only one in three gets treatment. One in three in the general population of the United States. Now, there is a greater acceptance for the treatment of depression in the United States than in Australia. I don't know the statistic, but I would hazard a guess that probably less than one in five in Australia gets treatment for it. That 4 out of 5 people just suffer through it. Unnecessarily, I should add. And even those who get treatment, a recent study has shown that of those who get treatment, just look at the just listen to the following. It absolutely fascinates me that of those who get treatment, take 100 of those people who get treatment, 50% of them will not follow through on the treatment. 25% of them, the treatment will be inadequate. In other words, the prescription is not the right prescription and it's not the right dose. Another 15%, the side effects will be unbearable, and so people will stop the treatment because they can't tolerate the side effects. Well, that's 50 and 25 and 15. What's that make? 90%? 90%? Which means 10%. 1 in 10 of those who get treatment will get adequate treatment. Can you see how serious this is? One of the things I've been doing while I'm on sabbatical, I've been on sabbatical since last July, and I've been preparing for board certification in prescribing, so I've been doing a whole lot of continuing education stuff in the area of treatment of biological depressions, and I know that stuff pretty good. And it just appalls me that so few people are being effectively treated for biological depression. They are suffering unnecessarily. And I think that one group of people that can help tremendously here are pastors. But you've got to overcome some of your bias towards it. I want to just lay out for you some basic principles so that you can understand what it is we're dealing with here. Biological, you're turning your page, and I don't know why. To right, okay, fine, fair enough. You can do that because I hadn't quite moved to the next point. I'm going to the treatment of endogenous depression is actually item 20. If you jump to that, because I want to deal with it before we take our break or start in on it. Treatment of endogenous depression. There's a couple of things you've got to understand about it. A, that there is this group of depressions that are clearly biological. There's no point in debating that, okay? That's the first point. The second point is that we do have effective treatment for it, and in the last 2 years, our ability to treat this problem has dramatically increased. Prior to that, when the first antidepressants were introduced. See, let me back up a moment. You have to take an antidepressant for a biological depression. You have to. There is no other way out. Cognitive therapy is used a lot in biological depressions, but the evidence is clear that on its own, you only get minimal improvement. You've got to take the antidepressant. So let's get that message out, okay? If you take an antidepressant and you don't have a biological depression, say it turns out to be a psychological depression, then the antidepressant has no effect whatsoever. No effect. If the defect isn't there, it doesn't do anything. If I don't have a broken leg and I put a splint on it, it doesn't fix anything because it's not broken. That's the first point. Second point is this. The antidepressant medications are not addicting. The problem with them is that people will not take them. That's the problem. Someone needs to add a little something addicting in them. Then we'd fix the problem. See, people won't take them. That's the problem. Non-compliance is the biggest problem in the treatment of biological depression. But by the way, the word endogenous is synonymous with biological. Endogenous. Biological, endogenous, meaning from within. It's not addicting. The problem with antidepressants is when you start taking it, you've got to take it for 3 weeks before you see any effect. Now, there's no drug that if you take it now and 3 weeks later you get the high. There's just no way something like that's addicting, see? And so the problem is a person starts taking it and they take it religiously and finally the depression lifts and it's like someone turned the light on. And then one night they forget to take their medication, and the next morning they don't feel any different, they still feel good. They say, well, maybe I'm cured now. The problem is, you see, it takes 3 weeks for the effect to come on, 2 to 3 weeks, and when you stop taking it, it's 2 to 3 weeks before the effect goes away. So you don't see the cause and effect relationship. There's this long period of onset. And only recently we've understood what that has to do. It has to do with something that happens in the nervous system, that the number of receptors, transmitter and receivers within a particular part of the nervous system has to increase, and it takes 2 to 3 weeks for them to grow, to replace that which is missing. Yes. No. You forgot that you're depressed. Yes, you forget you're depressed. That's it. You see, but that only speaks to the effectiveness of the treatment, see? And therefore, you don't... So non-compliance is the big thing. It's not addiction. Addiction is not the problem here. Now, in the tranquilizers for anxiety disorders, that's a whole nother kettle of fish. Is that an Australian expression? Yeah, it's a whole nother kettle of fish. But at least, now, just quickly, and we've got about 3 minutes, and then we're going to need to take our break. The essential defect in endogenous depression is a defect in the neurotransmitter. All you've got to understand there is that in the brain there are all types of nerve junctions that have chemicals in them. They are gaps. If you look at my fingers, they are gaps that look just like this. The nerve comes out, jumps the gap. These are relay stations, is really what they are. And this chemical inside here is called the neurotransmitter. That transmits the neuronal signal across the gap. And in endogenous depression, that is deficient. But there are hundreds of neurotransmitters. But only two of them are implicated in endogenous depression. And these two are, and I think you should know them. You can remember two, surely. Oh, that's easy to remember, huh? The two are... Do we have nothing to raise with, huh? The one is noradrenaline. Or abbreviated N-E. N-E. That's the one. And the second one... is serotonin. These are the names of the neurotransmitters, the substance that is in this gap. And of the hundreds of synapses, only two are implicated. And all antidepressants improve either this one or this one. A few of them improve both of them. So very simply, the process of treatment is finding which of those two is deficient. And the only way you can do that is to try various types of antidepressants and see, until you find one that works. Bingo, works. And it's one or the other, and some of them are shotguns that work both. But the more shotgun something is, the less specific it is, and the greater are the side effects. So the problem here is that if you have to use a shotgun, so be it, then you've got to learn to put up with the side effects. But to find... what you want is a smart bomb. That's the best analogy out there. A smart bomb that will hit exactly where the defect is. And of the antidepressants, the early ones that came out were mainly noradrenaline enhancers, and they were called TCAs or tricyclics. You hear the phrase tricyclics because of the chemical structure. There are three carbon ring. Those were the early ones. Those were shotguns. Because they didn't only improve the neurotransmitter, they did a lot of other stuff as well. They made your mouth dry. If you took them in the morning, they would sedate you. You'd fall asleep at the steering wheel. So they had so many side effects that for years we struggled with those because the side effects were often worse than the depression itself. But it's the best we had. Until a new group of antidepressants came out just a couple of years ago. And the one that is the head of the pack is Prozac. And these are known as just remember the abbreviation SSRIs. Stands for specific serotonin reuptake inhibitor. Smart bomb. And all the bad publicity Prozac has received has come primarily from one camp. And you know who that is? Scientologists have mounted a massive attack on Prozac. Why? Because they depend for their existence on people who are emotionally troubled coming into their system, mainly depressed, who they take through the E-meter, you know about the emotion meter, and they go through the pseudo-quackery thing, and that's how they win their people. Prozac came on the scene and dramatically turned depression around for scores and scores of people. And Scientologists suddenly lost their intake of new converts. So they have mounted, primarily the Scientologists, have mounted a massive attack against Prozac. Now, since Prozac, the effects, or there's a whole bunch of other SSRIs that are even better than Prozac. The problem with serotonin is that there are five different receptors of serotonin receptors. See, it gets more complicated. And of the five different serotonin receptors, only one of those is implicated in depression. So we need a smart bomb, because we know that only one of them, those that are shotgun for serotonin now, are being sharpened even more. So the next year or two, I mean, I've heard directly from some of the researchers that in the next year or two, we're going to have such a smart bomb that will hit and deal with depression and not have the side effects. Now, that's just my little spiel, which says, bottom line, this. Don't knock Prozac. Right at the back.